This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And happy 4th of July, everyone. We're going to begin today with a conversation about the War of Independence. For the American colonists, it was a stunning triumph, a victory of ideological revolutionaries and flinty farmers against the most powerful empire on earth.
For the British, however, the American Revolution was a stunning loss, a war of failed occupation, an empire stretched too far, a poorly executed war of choice and folly. If it sounds like there are some echoes of modern military history, that's because there are.
Andrew Jackson O'Shaughnessy is author of the new book, The Men Who Lost America, British Leadership, the American Revolution, and the Fate of the Empire. Andrew Jackson O'Shaughnessy, welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, thank you very much.
So this is a fascinating book because I can tell you from personal experience, this side of the revolution is pretty much never taught in American history courses in the United States. So let's start with sort of with the big picture here. What do you think are some of the most persistent misconceptions Americans have about the British and the British Army in particular during the revolution?
I think it's popular to believe that the war was lost by the incompetence of the British leadership. You know, they're often portrayed as aristocratic buffoons. This is particularly true in film, but also in popular history like Barbara Tuchman's The March of Folly, which devotes a third of the book essentially to presenting a parody of the British leadership.
Now, are they presented that way because on paper, Great Britain at the time had the world's most powerful navy, it had a professional army, it was able to tap global resources and credit in a way that possibly no other country could. It was the colonial power here in what would become the United States. So, you know, again, on paper, it should have been able to win this war.
It seemingly should have been able to win. And in fact, the British themselves have been as responsible as their American counterparts for perpetuating this idea that it was lost by poor leaders.
Well, what do you mean by that?
That it was due to incompetence and poor leadership rather than the problems that they confronted in this war.
Perhaps it makes it easier to stomach the loss of the colonies if popular history does lay blame at the feet of foolish men who were key figures in the British military. Let's talk about some of them and what you've actually discovered about who they really were. And one of the key figures is General Cornwallis.
You know, Cornwallis has only been the subject of one major scholarly biography, which is remarkable because he went on to have a very successful and important career as Lord Lieutenant of Ireland and then Governor General in India. And the perception and the popular representation of him is perhaps a film like The Patriot, in which Cornwallis is shown in an immaculate scarlet uniform sitting back at headquarters, worried more about his dogs than winning the war.
Why, after 6 weeks, am I still here in Middleton Place attending a ball in South Carolina when I should be attending balls in North Carolina? First, the theft of my personal baggage, including my memoirs, upon which I spent countless hours. Then half the bridges and ferries between here and Charlestown burned. Colonel, if you can't protect our supply lines against militia, how do you intend doing so against the colonial regulars or the French when they arrive?
My lord, they won't fight like regulars. We can't find them.
Colonel, they're militia. They're farmers with pitchforks.
They're rather more than that, I'm afraid, my lord.
Whereas the real Cornwallis was indeed the most aristocratic of the commanders, but he was also very much a professional army officer who joined the army in his teens. This was a man who burnt his tents and supplies at Wilmington in North Carolina and slept in the open air alongside with his troops. And they had a tremendous admiration of him because he suffered the same deprivations as they did. This was a man who was determined to win.
You point out in the book that that Cornwallis himself may have had a complex personal opinion about military action in the American Revolution because, as you note, he was only one of six members of the House of Lords to oppose the Stamp Act. So do we know more about personally what he felt regarding the British military trying to suppress this rebellion?
Well, this is very remarkable because the military leaders were much less hawkish than the civilian politicians and much more dubious about the idea of solving this by coercion. Cornwallis was indeed one of the only six members of the House of Lords to vote against the earliest attempt to tax America directly from Britain, the Stamp Act. And he remained dubious about those policies right up to the time of Lexington and Concord.
Was that same sense of uncertainty about what the British military was doing felt by the populace at large in Britain at the time?
There was considerable opposition once it became clear that Britain was moving towards war. You see this most in 1775, when you start to have a mass petitioning movement in Britain against the war. It's an interesting petitioning movement. It's the largest of its kind in British history until that point. It often involved towns and cities that weren't represented in Parliament, many of the new industrial towns in the north. There was also a highly articulate opposition in Britain in Parliament.
What did the British government feel was the driving imperative for fighting the war? It's easy to just presume that they didn't want to lose the colonies, but was there, you know, a bigger purpose behind it?
Well, interestingly, George III articulated the reasons for fighting better than really any of the ministers in the government. Initially, he saw it as a defence of the authority of Parliament over America. But increasingly, he argued that if Britain lost America, it would cease to be a major power in Europe. And so this is one myth that I think even prevails in America, that the British didn't think it was important.
With that driving imperative, let's talk about another one of the men in your book, The Men Who Lost America, and that is Lord George Germain, who's called the architect of the war.
And Germain, I think, is one of the shadowiest figures in the book. And Germain is one of the least known and yet the most important because he was the Secretary of State for America. He oversaw the logistics from London. He corresponded directly with the commanders. It's often imagined that the war was micromanaged from London. In fact, he understood very clearly that the commanders in the field needed to be given lots of discretion, that it would be impossible to make decisions without being on the spot. He was a former soldier himself. He did understand the nature of the war to some extent as well. He saw that it wasn't going to be a conventional war.
One of the most compelling arguments you make in your book is that essentially the British were fighting an insurgency in America. Did they recognize that?
They did. The commanders all recognized that the war was also about persuasion and winning over the population. From the very start of the war, they had an army of conquest, but not an army of occupation. You know, they had enough troops to take every city in America, but they could never conquer and hold territory. There would be insurgencies led by people we think of as folk heroes today, like Thomas Sumter and Marion Fox, in which British authority would collapse. Sir Henry Clinton, who's a little-known commander-in-chief in the second half of the war, actually used the phrase winning hearts and minds. But I think if the book shows anything, it's that the revolution was popular.
So, Andrew Jackson O'Shaughnessy, as we were reading your book here at Radio Boston, the thing that most took us aback was how, if you just change names and dates, this is a story that's been told in the centuries since the American Revolution. I mean, the examples are many. A situation in which the military is less hawkish than civilian leadership, that part of the motivation is a concern of the loss of geopolitical power, or that victory might expand executive power, or that you send a military force that's a conquering force, not an occupying one, or the belated recognition that it's an insurgency that you're fighting and that hearts and minds must be won. I mean, obviously, to listeners, this is all language that has been bandied about by the United States itself, and most recently in the Iraq War.
There are parallels. For example, the British debated whether the militia could be regarded as enemy combatants and whether they should be given the full rights of prisoners of war. Because as far as they were concerned, they were rebels against just authority and could be hung for treason. I didn't set out to make any political parallels. Historians are always a bit nervous of analogies that eventually replace analysis. This book is not a commentary on the present. Instead, the present helped me to think about the past.
Well, Andrew Jackson O'Shaughnessy is the author of The Men Who Lost America, British Leadership, the American Revolution, and the Fate of the Empire. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much indeed for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.